tonight. Good evening and welcome to this evening's programme talk at the Staple Inn Actuarial Society. My name is Natanya Rolofsa and I'm the Honorary Secretary of SIAS. Before I introduce tonight's talk, I have a couple of notices about upcoming SIAS events. Our next programme talk will be a discussion on analysing analytics, given by Matthew Edwards and Rachel McNaughton. And this talk will take place on Tuesday, the 5th of June. For further details, you guys can have a look on the website. Our next social is our first ever darts tournament. So for those of you interested in that, please look on the website as well. That's on Tuesday, the 29th of May. Next, a few standard notices about tonight's event. There's an attendance sheet in the smaller room just outside the hall. So if you didn't sign this on the way in, don't forget to sign it on the way out. Attendance at these talks does not automatically get added to your CPD records, so please do remember to update the CPD in the usual way after tonight. And we're eager to hear our feedback from you guys on talks, so please, we'll email you a short online survey after the talk. Please take a minute or two to complete this. We do need your feedback to create the best possible experience for all of you. And then if the fire alarm sounds during the meeting, please exit using the fire exits at the back of the hall. There's no test going on tonight. And then finally, a reminder to switch your mobile phones to silent. Tonight's talk will last around an hour and will be followed by a Q&A with the speakers. So if you've got a question, please raise your hand and a microphone will be brought to you. We do value everyone's contribution at our talk, so there's a bottle of champagne on offer for the best contribution to the discussion by a student member of the IFOA, and also another for the best contribution from any fellow of the IFOA, regardless of the number of years post-qualification. Please clearly state your name and which of these categories you fall into before you ask your questions tonight. Following the meeting, there will be sandwiches and networking drinks in the smaller room just outside the hall, so we hope you join us there afterwards. Back to tonight's talk. Ross Hamilton, Nicola Oliver, and Matthew Edwards are all members of the IFOA's Antibiotic Resistance Working Party. Ross works in pension risk management for Lloyds Banking Group and is a qualified pensions actuary. He has been involved in the literature review and modelling work streams. And then Nicola is head of longevity and mortality research for medical intelligence and brings medical insights into the working party. Matthew is chair of the Antibiotic Resistance Working Party, and he's also active in mortality work elsewhere in the profession as deputy chair of the CMI and also sitting on the Mortality Research Steering Committee. He's a director at Willis Towers Watson, where he leads demographic and analytics work in the life practice. On that note, over to you, Matt.
Okay, thank you very much, Natanya. Thank you very much, everyone, for coming to what I will be a very interesting event for sort of people in all different areas of life insurance and pensions. So I was sort of thinking of this by analogy to a bit of a relay race. So Natanya's just done sort of 100 metres worth of relay race with the baton, which I've got here, actually. And past me, and I'm just doing 10 metres worth, which is actually quite hard work in the heat. And then my two fellow antibioticers, or whatever the right noun is, are going to do a couple of miles each, so they'll be doing the hard work. So I'll pass over them shortly, but they've been very instrumental, staple in the working party's work over the last year or so. With Nicola, as you might imagine from the CV, specialising in the medical input, and Ross heavily involved in the modelling, which is not to at all diminish the works of the other working party contributors, especially around some of the parameterisation. So over to you.
I expect some of you have been and heard me speak about the antibiotic resistance issues in the past, maybe here a couple of years ago. And in fact, the working party was set up really on the back of an event that took place, I think, about 2 years ago here. And since then, the push has been towards a greater understanding of antibiotic research, antibiotic resistance, and how that might affect such things as mortality trends and disease risk. So from that point of view, as I say, we started to develop the idea for a working party 2 years ago. A longevity bulletin was published, I believe, later that year. And then we have actually been set up since the beginning of last year. The aim really is to try and develop a set of plausible scenarios to allow the Alatris develop their own views on the likely mortality impacts of antibiotic resistance. We're going to start this on a UK context because at the moment we've got good data to allow us to do that directly from the NHS, who are able to do some excellent record keeping for us. But we're also hoping that's going to be transferable to other countries. So these are the working party members, as you can see, and we have excellent input from the teams with all different types of background experience. So I'll make a start by starting with a medical overview. So I do apologise if people already understand quite clearly about antibiotic resistance, having listened to us say this once or twice in the past, but it's good just to recap so we can understand where we are and what we're going to be looking at next. So actually, what is antibiotic resistance? Well, it's an area of great concern because it's rising exponentially around the world, and in fact was recognised by Alexander Fleming way back when he first discovered the presence of antibiotics in the form of penicillin. And antibiotic resistance is something that is not as a result of the antibiotic itself, but through use of the antibiotic. And this happens through two ways. Some bacteria become resistant, and they're able to pass on their resistance to either their offspring or to fellow bacteria. So they're a very smart pathogen. It's able to transfer resistance in this way. And this really is drawn from Darwin's theory of resistance and evolution, because it's those fitter, more resistant bacteria that are able to resist the action of antibiotics and therefore carry on the process of developing more antibiotic resistance. So it's the use of antibiotics as such that has provided an environment in which antibiotic resistance can occur. Now, we are also aware that there are other types of microbial resistant strains, which are not just bacteria. We're concerned more with bacteria because the rates of mortality are much higher with such things as sepsis and some of the more severe infections. But there is also resistance developing in terms of resistance to antiviral drugs, as also antifungal drugs. So first of all, how do antibiotics work? Well, there are two approaches to getting rid of a bacterial pathogen. So the first type is through the bactericidal group of antibiotics, and you'll recognise some of the names of those antibiotics up there on the left. The one that would most probably stand out is the penicillins. They come under the beta-lactame class. And they simply attack the cell wall of the bacteria, causing it to split open and therefore be no longer functional. And this works by attacking the proteins that the bacteria requires in order to continue to reproduce. Weaker bacterial cells are then developed, and over time, the effectiveness of the bacteria doing its job is completely diminished. The second type of attack is from the inside, and this is where these classes of bacteria, antibiotics, are able to invade the bacterial cell and actually prevent the cell from dividing quite as fast as it normally would. So normal DNA replication is halted or slowed down, and that gives the body and your own immune system the opportunity to work on those particular pathogens. And they divide much more slowly, and they don't have the opportunity to invade. Some classes of antibiotics can be both of these, by the way, but on the whole, we tend to have this sort of double-pronged approach. So how has this come about? Well, there are quite a few different theories as to why we have reached the position where antibiotics, which have been developed to battle against infectious diseases, have now become really quite obsolete. Originally, causes of death by infectious diseases was quite high. If you look through at causes of death rates going back to the 20s and 30s, death from infection disease outsurpassed all other causes. As antibiotics have been developed, we've been able to very successfully treat a majority of bacterial infections. And the main issue about a bacterial infection is if it becomes advanced to a point where it enters the bloodstream, that is when it becomes serious. So managing infection is really based around trying to prevent that kind of development. So there are many different thoughts about how it has got to the point where we've got to. Originally, their antibiotics have found their way into the food chain. So the farming industry have been known for many decades to use antibiotics as a form of growth promoter, and certainly not used in a way that is just indicated for illness. So we know that antibiotics have entered the food chain in this way. So you'll be eating farming produce that has antibiotics in it. So you're getting a small amount of antibiotic in meat consumption. The other issue has been around direct contact between humans and animals in a very similar way, and some environmental factors. But at the core of it all is overuse of antibiotics, particularly in the situation where you have an infection that is not from a bacterial origin. Most coughs and colds, most standard infections that we all have had are actually viral in origin. There is nothing that an antibiotic can do against a virus. It is completely ineffective. A virus will eventually just play itself out. Some viruses can be quite serious. We have some antiviral drugs, but certainly antibiotics are not in that category. And we've reached a sort of society where we expect to be treated with some kind of medication when we are ill or approach a GP. So there's been two issues, one on expectation, the other has been on doctors over-prescribing. So we've reached this particular point now where they're becoming more and more ineffective. And how does that really translate? So the one core issue that we're concerned about is septicemia, because you're not going to die from a urine infection if it contained within your bladder. You're not going to die from a small lung infection or a throat infection. What you are going to die from is if some of those pathogens, the bacteria, enter your bloodstream. And there are stages throughout our lives when these opportunities do arise. So if we start from the young age going there, from 0 up to 18, things like meningitis, routine trauma cuts and grazes are more of a concern. Moving through to childbirth, thankfully we don't use antibiotics routinely in childbirth at all. They're only used in situation for perceived infection or for surgical intervention, right through to some of the more common interventions that we might require, heart surgery, joint replacement, and certainly to treat pneumonia. And if we look across the bottom boxes there, you can see the four main routes in for pathogens into the body, and this is where some pathogens become such a problem to individuals that they go from those particular areas on into the bloodstream. For instance, we know that a urinary tract infection can ascend through to the kidneys and become very, very difficult to treat, leading to septicemia. In fact, I believe that 40% of all septicemias arise as a result of a particular pathogen that is very prevalent in the urinary tract, and that's E. coli, and that's something that we have been modelling. The respiratory tract is a source for bacteria, particularly in older people where they're much more susceptible to pneumonias, which develop as a matter of course after severe lung disease. And not just in terms of reacting to illness, there are some surgeries and some interventions which also require the use of antibiotics. So we're looking at things such as cardiac defibrillators or joint replacements, any opportunity for a device to be placed inside the body, you will require antibiotic cover for that. So there's also a morbidity concern here. And some scenarios have been discussed where we're no longer able to perhaps carry out as many joint replacement surgeries as we might have been able to previously. And this will result in greater levels of disability and may well also impact mortality. So these concerns relate to not just increased and excess mortality, but lives that are lived longer with disability potentially. So we've now reached the point where the World Health Organization are having to track the research and development of antibiotics much more closely. And last year they released their latest priority list of antibiotic-resistant pathogens. Previously to this, the research and development that had gone on in terms of trying to develop new drugs had been very slow, and the approach has been slightly changed, and as you can see, there's a list of criteria there. So the World Health Organization looked at those particular criteria in order to try and identify which pathogens are of most concern. And this was based on such things as their mortality risk, their ability to be transmitted easily, where they sat inside the healthcare setting, and whether there was any pipeline developments in terms of pharmaceuticals. So those three red boxes describe the three top critical pathogens and the type of antibiotic they're resistant to. And what's key in all of those three is that the type of antibiotics they're resistant to, carbapenem and also cephalosporin, these antibiotics tend to be reserved for critical infections. They are antibiotics of last resort. So the top one there, Acinetobacter baumannii, we'll just call it A. baumannii going forward for ease. So this is a particularly nasty pathogen which sits very comfortably in the hospital setting. And it is very common and prevalent amongst people who are very vulnerable in terms of they are being nursed in intensive care. And the issue with intensive care, which relates back to the root sin of infection, is that most patients are hooked up to several types of invasive devices. A breathing tube, for instance, allows pathogens to march quite directly down to the lungs. Catheters in for urinary collection, catheters in for depositing blood and taking blood. So not only is an intensive care patient already severely compromised, but then we start poking holes in their skin, which allows more and more pathogens to gather. Research tells us that A. baumannii has been driven principally by use of antibiotics that they have developed a fantastic resistance to and poor infection control measures. And we're talking very simple infection control measures, hand washing between patients, hand washing between procedures, and simple dusting of environments. A. baumannii is able to sit on a dusty shelf along with MRSA for many months, dormant, and then be activated again. So the environment itself needs to be scrupulously clean. Even more of a concern is that A. baumannii is now demonstrating resistance to an antibiotic called colistin. Colistin is an old antibiotic that was used in the 60s and 70s and is absolutely the antibiotic of last resort because it also causes kidney failure, so it would be used in extremis. And this pathogen is now demonstrating resistance to that. So a very resilient pathogen, and one of the pathogens that we intend as a working party to examine more closely in terms of modelling its effect on mortality. Pseudomonas is a very common pathogen, in fact probably responsible for a lot of mild infections, but also is responsible for some very serious infections. It again enjoys the healthcare setting and takes advantage of poor infection control measures, and therefore has a very similar risk profile to A. baumannii. It's one of the key pathogens responsible for some of the very difficult to treat pneumonias. Pneumonia, of course, is a high risk factor to lead on to the septicemia. So this will be another pathogen that we hope to be able to look at in terms of modelling its effectiveness. Both of these pathogens are particularly prevalent in vulnerable people, even more so with weakened immune systems. I mentioned previously E. coli. E. coli comes from a family of the Enterobacters, and this is another pathogen that has been showing increasing signs of prevalence, both in the hospital setting and in the community. Here we can see the rates of resistance across Europe, showing the UK in the yellow band, I believe. This resistance has led to increasing rates of the blood-borne infection that I mentioned. So urinary infections that have reached the circulatory system as a result of inability to control the growth rate of the bacteria. It's very difficult to treat as a pathogen and is definitely associated with increased mortality. In fact, if you are diagnosed with septicemia, the mortality rate can be up to 80%. So there has been some interest, of course, in how this might affect not just economic instability, but also how it might have an impact on global population loss and mortality. So this particular review, which was undertaken by Jim O'Neill and the final analysis released in 2016, suggests that we'll be losing this number of deaths every year by 2050 around the world. We have looked at this report, and it's very useful as it informs some kind of thinking, but the methodology wasn't particularly clear, and this is another reason that spurred us into thinking about how we could make better use of our modelling understanding. But tackling resistance takes a long time. Not only have you got to be able to identify the emerging pathogens that are going to be resistant to antibiotics, we have to change the behaviours of whole societies. And developing new antibiotics is a very slow process. There have been no new classes of antibiotics released to market for some time. So we're really sort of in the danger zone still. We're not anywhere near safe. Research just published this year unfortunately identified that use of antibiotics has actually increased between 2000 and 2015. Consumption rate has gone up by almost 40% globally, and defined daily doses by 65%. And this is against all of the global strategies that have been put in place. This increase was driven largely by low and middle income countries where regulation of the sale and use of antibiotics is less stringent. And interestingly, consumption was closely correlated with capita growth per head capita. Secondary to that, looking at particular populations, in India, for instance, it's possible to buy antibiotics over the counter, and these are often in what's known as a fixed dose combination, so they may come along with more than one antibiotic in one particular dose, so you're often exposing yourself to more than one kind of antibiotic. Self-dosing is also not recommended. Likely chances that most people don't have a bacterial infection, and the widespread use of this is exposing patients to unneeded antibiotics. You might have read as well about the case of a UK resident who developed a very unpleasant antibiotic-resistant case of gonorrhea. It didn't respond in the normal way to the antibiotics that would normally treat it, and he required hospitalisation and intravenously introduced antibiotics to really kick that infection. And there have been two more cases, I believe, in Australia. So when these type of cases start to occur, you can possibly bet quite high that that's going to make its way into higher numbers. Gonorrhea tends to lead to things like infertility, pelvic inflammatory disease, and other ongoing problems like that. And occasionally, and in rare occasions, it can itself lead to the blood-borne infection that I described earlier. So given all of the risk factors, given what we know about antibiotic resistance and all of the efforts that have been put in place recently to try and combat this issue, we had hoped to be able to look at some slightly more positive news. So one of the problems has been how to discover antibiotics. There was at one time research and interest in looking at natural products from which bacteria are formed. So there's the potential for millions more bacteria and their resulting bacteria antibiotics in the soil. And for some period of time, this type of route was ignored, principally because scientists kept coming up with the same pathogens and the same antibiotics. But a new type of platform to be able to identify new antibiotics has been developed. And this has been looking at a class of antibiotic called amalacidin. And this has really top-class activity against some of the more multi-drug-resistant pathogens. And the researchers have used a combination of things like genetic sequencing and other analysis and have been able to move towards identifying new treatments. Again, looking more at the genetic side, research that was published just at the end of last year actually looked at unknown genes within bacteria that were making them resistant to antibiotics. So by being able to almost edit the DNA of the pathogen. They're able to try and reduce the propensity of that bacteria to become resistant to antibiotics. Very similarly, horizon scanning now, but CRISPR, which is a type of gene editing, has been shown to have potential use in looking at bacteria in terms of switching off their ability to be resistant to certain types of antibiotics. So it's looking more towards less traditional methods of dealing with bacteria, the ones I described earlier in terms of breaking the cell wall or disrupting the DNA. This would be a route to being able to switch off the bacterial propensity to be resistant. So I'll hand over to Ross now, who's going to take us through some of the structure of the model and parameterization. This is based around the one pathogen that we've looked at so far, which is E. coli, and we hope to be able to include other pathogens in this as we go forward. Thank you.
Guys, for those standing at the back, there's seats in the front here if you want to come sit. There's four.
Give you all a second to get seated. All right, so thanks very much, Nicola. That was very, very interesting and really gave a great introduction to the working party and all the information that has gone into how we're going to apply that to the actuarial field. So I'd now like to take you through some of the model structure and parameterization that we've been going through so far. And really, in order to do that, we had to take a step back and start from the beginning to actually define the objective of what we're trying to achieve. And we decided after some discussion that we'd like to model the impact of both mortality and morbidity within the modelling structure. And then a few kind of criteria that we'd set out for the model. So it needed to be simple yet complex enough to be able to actually capture the various different interactions going on here. But also we wanted it to have flexibility so that, for example, if other users such as yourself wanted to go in there, change some of the settings or look at different data or even add on different pathogens, you were able to do that. So those are the criteria that we'd set out when looking at the model. And once we'd had identified that, we then undertook a literature review to see what else was out there. And there was quite a bit that had been produced over the past 10 to 15 years. Mostly academic research, in fact. However, most notably, there was the recent O'Neill review published in 2016, as Nicola mentioned. And as part of that review, both KPMG and RAND were commissioned to produce a model for that publication. So that was a natural starting point for us. And as Nicola mentioned, the methodology was slightly unclear, but when we managed to find some information about it and did a bit of digging, it turned out that the methodology they had used was driven by economic factors rather than the specific kind of pathogen factors that we wanted to look at within our working group. So whilst it was useful to have that as a starting point, we decided to go a slightly different route and actually then drifted towards some of the academic papers that we had found. And the approach that seemed to be fairly universal across all of those was actually looking at a multi-state Markov model. And so that is the approach that we decided to take. So if I can get this to work. So here's a very, very simple diagram of our multi-state Markov model. And as you'll see, there's four states. You have the healthy state, sick with a resistant infection, or sick with a non-resistant infection. And in addition, we decided to... we've also got, obviously, the death state at the end. So we decided when looking at whether to use a continuous time or a discrete time version. So far we're using a discrete time version just to kind of simplify some of the calculation processes. So Once we had come to the conclusion on what type of model we were going to create, we then needed to set up the parameterization work stream, who were going to look at informing the transition intensities from moving between different states. So, what data is available for informing those transition intensities? So since it's a Markov model, we were able to take observed data and take averages of that observed data to inform the transition intensities. And as you can see on the left-hand side here, we've got a few different sources that were available. So you have Public Health England, the ECDC, or more specifically in the ECDC, there's the European Antibiotic Resistance Surveillance Network, or shortened to EARS. You've got the ONS, and then also PLOS at the bottom, which is a depository for various research papers, which helps supplement some of the missing data that we didn't have. So to start with, we looked at what information is there actually on resistance, and that's where we headed to the EARS network. And in the EARS network, they produce quite helpfully data going back to around 2000, I think, on resistance rates to various different pathogens and resistance to different antibiotics for each of those pathogens. And that's across Europe and also segregated by area. So specifically, we were able to look at the UK and Ireland out of that data set. Now, I think one thing we have to draw out of, an important point we need to draw out of this, is that an antibiotic, a certain pathogen, is not necessarily resistant in absolute to a single antibiotic, for example. It might have multi-drug resistance, and I think as Nicola was mentioning earlier, that is almost the more dangerous case, where you suddenly don't have any more antibiotics that you're able to use to fight against that pathogen. And I suppose for the modelling that we've done so far, we have actually treated it as an absolute case, but that's just something to bear in mind, that resistance can have different definitions, as you might find it, in various different data sources. So now that we're able to gather the resistance data from the EARS network, we were then able to combine that with incidence rates for bacteremia, if I pronounce that correctly. And bacteremia, for those who didn't know, who don't know, because I certainly didn't know before starting this, is getting a bacteria in the bloodstream, which, yeah, so such as septicemia. And that's one of the routes that can lead to death. So the information that was available here was taken from Public Health England, and Public Health England produced various different for various different categories of types of bacteria, the number of reports, and then also the fatality rates from those reports as well. I guess one of the key themes that is across all the different data sets here is, whilst there were a few places to look, the data is certainly limited in terms of how far back it goes and in what context it's been set out. And also there could be the potential for some bias within the data as well. So just again, one to just kind of keep in mind and something that we'll be setting out within the model documentation. So now we were able to get the resistance data, and we were then combining that with the incidence of getting a certain bacteria. If I just flick back a couple of slides, hopefully this works. We were then able to inform the first two areas of transition there, so healthy to sick, either resistant or non-resistant. And so once we were able to get those transition intensities identified, finally we were looking at the death rates for various different bacteremia. And again, the source here was the public health data, but in this instance we had to supplement it with additional research provided by PLOS, where we just were looking at what the relationship was between a cause of death from a resistant bacteria and a non-resistant bacteria. So there was a slight link that we've had to make there. And finally, so once we have all that data, we now have everything we need to determine a starting position for our multi-state Markov model. So beyond that, we then also needed to isolate, okay, well, how does the actual trend in resistance, how is that going to be affected, and how is that going to affect mortality and morbidity? So for a start, we've just looked at mortality for now. And again, we've gone back to the EARS network, where as you can see on the bottom left here, you've got the trends in resistance over the last 15 or so years. And so from that trend, you can extrapolate out a graph. So this is a simplistic version of what we've done so far, where we've just taken a straight line approach to looking at resistance going forward over the next 20 or so years. However, as part of the working group and some of the developments we'll be making in the future, we'd also like to look at various different scenarios. So for example, you could have increasing exponential growth, you could have tapered growth, or you could even have some type of inflection point in the future. All of these types of extrapolation will inform how resistance will impact on both mortality and morbidity. These are just some of the other considerations, and Nicola touched on a couple of these just before, and these will largely feed into how we actually extrapolate resistance. So for example, Nicola mentioned it's been 30 years since a new class of antibiotic has been introduced. So it's not unbelievable to say that it could take another 30 years for a new class of antibiotic to be introduced, and you might consider almost unrestricted growth in resistance up until that point. Alternatively, you could consider some of the global public health missions that are going on at the moment, and that could actually have the effect of changing public attitudes towards antibiotics, and you could have something like the inflection point that I showed you on the previous slide. So, on to the results of the model. So we've essentially created an example based on E. coli, and we run the model 20 years into the future to have a look at and try and produce some draft results on to what its impact on mortality might look like. And here's a slide summarizing those results. So probably worth me explaining that first, or the second bullet point down there. So the growth in E. coli bacteria resistant to third generation cephalosporin antibiotics, and as I understand it, this type of antibiotic is considered one of the last resorts for treating E. coli, so resistance to this antibiotic is particularly important. And then in terms of age group, we've got quite a large age group, but we just looked at what we defined as the working age population. And we, again, as I mentioned, we projected the position 20 years into the future. And so the results indicated that under a plausible central scenario, the probability of dying in the next year would increase by about 1% relative to had resistance just stayed the same. And in addition, we've also looked at what an extreme scenario might look like, and that figure could double or triple. And it's probably worth noting that is just for one strain of bacteria, so there could be some additive effect for looking at multiple strains of bacteria as we plan to do so in the later developments of the model. And maybe just put that into a bit of context. So it's probably not unbelievable to think that if you looked at multiple strains of bacteria under a central scenario, and you were using, for example, the CMI model with a long-term trend of 1.5%, this type of impact could bring down that long-term trend by, say, 0.25% per annum. So just putting that into a bit of context. And then, of course, in a more extreme scenario, you'd be looking at much more severe impact. So the intention here is that the model will help everyone in this room and hopefully the actuarial world have a better understanding of just putting some numbers and putting some impacts to antibiotic resistance in the context of how we look at longevity, mortality, and morbidity. So next steps for the working party. So model development. As Nicola mentioned, we're looking to increase the parameterization for a number of different other pathogens. And also, we want to identify what the interactions are between those pathogens as well, because it's quite conceivable there'll be some overlap or kind of multiplicative effect between them. We'll then be moving on to validating and documenting the model. And then the model will be available for full release, accompanied by a suggested parameterization on UK data and a research paper to go with it. And that will be presented at a sessional meeting in February 2019. And I think we're hoping for some draft results for the LIFE conference in November 2018. Okay, so I guess we'll just open up to any questions or comments. Thank you very much.
Well, Peter, is it? You state your name just for the benefit of everyone.
My name is Peter Carr. I'm not a student. Thanks for a very interesting presentation. I certainly learned a lot. My mother, who was a very young nurse in the Second World War, told me that on D-Day they were given penicillin, and prior to that, anyone who had a stomach wound was bound to die, and all they could do was ease their pain, and she couldn't believe the difference that penicillin made. So one hopes we're not losing that. My question is really, though, you mentioned that you were modelling the working age population. Would it have made a difference had you studied the more chronologically challenged?
Well, yeah, I mean, in general terms, our model will be looking at all age ranges, so we'll be looking at sort of younger and older.
But the impact might be greater for the elderly,
or
the
proportionally less in older ages.
I don't know.
But, I mean, the model will be sort of parameterized at all ages. And one of the problems with the older ages is the fact that it's not so much the direct impact of septicemia or whatever it might be in killing off. It's also the fact that the high risk of, for instance, septicemia or other ABR problems might actually cause you not to have whatever surgery it is that you should be getting. Do you want to comment on?
Yeah, so the sort of areas Matthew mentioned, which I briefly touched on, are, and one I didn't mention actually, first of all, is chemotherapy for some cancers. Chemotherapy renders the immune system rather low, and so it's not unusual for patients to also receive prophylactic antibiotics to cover them during that time. So the possible scenarios are that people succumb more to the type of what's called a neutropenic infection, so lack of white blood cells during the time they're receiving chemotherapy, and succumb to mortality because of that, or they simply don't receive the chemotherapy and therefore their cancer is not controlled in the way it might normally have done. Similarly, things like hip replacements, knee replacements, these type of very common joint surgeries must be accompanied by antibiotics, and this is to reduce the risk of infection. One of the most difficult to treat infections are those that invade the bones, and it's not unusual to find patients having to be treated for 6 months or more with infections in order to counter that. And additional to that, any surgery that takes place in the bowel has to have an antibiotic cover, principally because the bowel is a dirty area. If you are cutting into the bowel and you risk just a few cells of pathogens that are quite happily residing in the bowel, they're no problem at all. But if they reach other parts of your body, then you're in trouble. So maybe bowel surgery will be impacted. And some modelling work has looked at, particularly in the US, the amount of surgery that goes on there for these type of interventions will lead to a huge impact on morbidity in terms of extended rates of disability. Possibly from, you know, reasonably young age, 60s and 70s, when someone might otherwise have a very successful hip replacement operation.
I've got a question at the front as well. Very sorry.
You I was wondering whether you, my name is Ian McKeever, I was wondering whether you could comment a bit more on the age-related effect, because I'm a wee bit older than you, therefore you're probably fitter than me, but I have probably got a more advanced immune system than you've got, because I've been fighting infection for longer than you have.
That's relevant for viruses. Bacteria, you can be reinfected over and over again with the same bacteria, and there's little much that your immune system will do with that. In fact, older people, unfortunately, have a reduced ability to deal with infectious diseases because their immune system is less effective in that area. It's a virus that your immune system can recognise, mm-hmm. and then, for instance, that's how certain influenzas will affect very specific age groups. You see that sometimes, and younger people are much more vulnerable because of the exact reason you've been exposed to multiple mm-hmm. influenza viruses, and your immune system recognises the clever disguise that a virus will put on.
I guess we will be looking at the age-related data to define some differences between ages throughout the model. It's just, I guess, for the purpose of the initial run, we just had to group that into a large data set for now.
Oh, Stephen.
Hello, Stephen Baxter, Club Theatre Fellow. I've got a question, really, I suppose, of three parts, if I may, which relates to the sources of antibiotic resistance. You said earlier the important role both the food chain and prescribing played in this dynamic, and I wonder if you might be able to elaborate on the balance between the two, what the extent to which our consumption of low-dose antibiotics through the food chain is a driver versus resistance from over-prescribing. And then leading on from that, I wonder if you might be able to comment on some of the interventions we may take. So would it be, for instance, more productive to provide taxing antibiotics out of the food chain, or would it be more effective to change prescribing behaviours, for example, suggesting to GPs they don't prescribe antibiotics? I'm not sure what the economics of that are, given the cheapness of antibiotics versus prescription charges, but I'd be interested in the working party's thoughts.
The issue between the farming industry and prescribing in humans has obviously been quite debated. Farming, the issue of antibiotics in farm animals was discovered quite serendipitously in the 50s in the US, where they found that chickens that had been treated with antibiotics seemed to grow hugely faster than their counterparts who hadn't, and that was an indicated use, because animals still require antibiotic intervention. And so they were introduced into farming animals as a growth promoter, and that has been driven by economics and also the requirement of populations for cheaper, faster meat to the plate. And looking at research that came out last year, they looked at some of the genetic profile of some of those early pathogens which are now still present that have come through the food chain. So there's a suspicion that that was more key in its driver of resistance compared to, for instance, prescribing in humans on an indicated basis. I suspect that will continue to be debated. Now, in the UK, we have very strict regulations on whether or not antibiotics can be given to animals. It has to be indicated in terms of an infection, and they're not used in the UK as a growth promoter. So UK-derived meat, theoretically, should not have antibiotics that have been given as a growth promoter, but of course they'll be there for other indications. Meat that has derived from other places, we don't have any control over. We're allowed to import that meat into this country and it can be used. So possibly in the sort of more, mass-produced, cheaper type fast food, perhaps. I'm not saying it's that at all, but, I'm just sort of speculating. And from a prescribing point of view, part of the stewardship that you describe is certainly around reducing prescribing. Again, I speak on the UK. GPs have been instructed to not prescribe in the case of a suspected viral infection. The difficult thing is you can't discern between a virus and a bacteria at the desk. So there is actually a competition on by the Longitude Prize to develop a bedside immediate test to differentiate between a bacterial and viral infection, which will allow you to then prescribe appropriately. And also to show the patient, this is a virus, there's nothing that an antibiotic is going to do. Other parts of stewardship involve the remuneration of drug development. Currently, it's pretty much on a volume-led sales-type remuneration, which works perfectly for such things as antihypertensive, other drugs that you have to take for the rest of your life. But in antibiotic R&D, there's little incentive to go down that route. So there's certainly movement to try and rejig the whole economic model of remuneration. Unfortunately, as I said, highlighted some research last year that said actually prescribing is going up. This is driven by the low and middle income economies. As they increase their income per capita, that correlates well with increasing access to antibiotics, which are not regulated. So what was the final part of your question? Just remind me.
Yes, I missed the third part. You said you had three parts.
Yeah, I think that was it, wasn't it? Yeah.
It was. I think I omitted the third part, which was merely to ask if the working party were going to do some scenario analysis as part of the modelling, looking at some of these possible changes.
Yes, that's in terms of the ways we're showing up and down graphs, you want to look at various scenarios, but part of the aim of the model release would be effective to give you users that power. I mean, two things I'd add to that about the food chain and intervention and so on. One is quite interesting case study that came out of the US a couple of years ago. This is on the back of that being, I think, the first country where this use of antibiotics for growth promotion had been promoted. Was a sense of public outcry two or three years ago, and it sort of became apparent that so many chickens have been going down this route. And one of the main chicken fast food outlets, I think it's called Chick-A-Fil or something like that, sort of decided to sort of make it clear to its eaters that it was moving entirely to some non-antibiotic grown or promoted, boosted chickens. I think it's quite a good sign if you can get that sense of public pressure to get the food or the manufacturers or catering chains or whatever to change their habits. That's quite a good thing. And the other point is the whole international aspect. And then if that's, that good thing might be happening in the US or over here, but then if rather like global warming, if we all throw our cars and cycle to work, but then the whole of China and India have still got all their gases chugging out, it's quite hard to be acting in isolation.
Any questions from a student, actually?
Hi, I'm Lisa Ullman-Richer, and I'm a student. And coming from a health insurance background, I guess I'm interested in learning more about how you might extend the model to quantify morbidity, and also if you've considered the impact of socioeconomic status in terms of antibiotic resistance rates, because, of course, those people that are insured might not have the same risk as getting antibiotic resistance than the non-insured or the general population in the UK.
So the main... Yeah, what do you want to talk about the outlook?
Yeah, no, it's a good question. In short, yes, we did consider that impact, and it's largely down to what data is available, and I think the data has been a bit thin in terms of certain aspects of it. But certainly, where we can break it down further, we would like to. And in terms of extending the model to include morbidity, so the morbidity aspect, we'll look at actually the waiting times that you're within the sickness state. So whereas the mortality impact was just looking at, I suppose, the instance of actually reaching the final death state. So hopefully we don't need to expand it to include that element, but we are looking to expand it to potentially include some additional states for other various pathogens.
So we could have a socioeconomic multiplier for mortality quite easily in the model. The question or the problem is clearly parameterising that in a sensible way. So we probably end up adding that in. Always release it with parameters you're set to one and allow people to play around with it. More champagne to be won. Mark?
Mark Cooper, fellow. This is an annoying question, but I appreciate you've looked at one pathogen, E. coli, and I was just trying to get a sense, and I know you're alluding to that, you're coming onto that on your further work, but is it 1 of 10, 1 of 100? Or is it more that it's an important one for mortality outcomes and there are only a couple of others that are important for mortality outcomes?
So the World Health Organization have compiled their list of pathogens of concern. The three are highlighted are their top three out of 10. There's 10 that they are concentrating on based on those criteria that I mentioned, and mortality being one of them, but also the ability to be able to tackle it. So we're just going to look at the top three for now.
I thought we were going to look at least the top four, aren't we? But we could always, probably worth actually adding a bucket in the model as well, so people can put whatever sort of pathogens they have in their pockets into the bucket and play around with that as well. But clearly we need to have a fairly finite number. And one of the problems which you hinted at earlier is then when you've got more than a few pathogens trying to work out what's going to be happening between them.
Hello, I'm Hamad Hashemi, I'm a student. One of the things that that I'm interested in is the long-term care. So I've been looking at, I know that dementia is the main cause of death in the UK currently, and I was thinking in your model, would you be considering competing risks where people actually die from dementia or other old age diseases before even getting the antimicrobial resistant bacteria.
I'm trying to keep that out of scope to avoid extending the project by another 5 years.
Yeah. It's interesting to think ICD-11 is going to include some extended causes of death involving a wider range of antibiotic, resistant bacterial infections. So that's not officially in use yet, but that might help. But
that's
not
news, no.
Yeah, everybody that gets an infection and dies from it. Doesn't necessarily have the pathogen isolated. This is the other problem, of course. People who are seriously in hospital with an infection that is difficult to treat has the pathogen isolated. So there could be another cause of death. Yeah, so too tricky.
Got a question. In terms of the robustness of the data, how can we be sure that we're happy with the data and the data is robust enough for us to use?
I think it's going to be a case of understanding what data we have and the limitations of it, because there's not much and it doesn't necessarily go back as far as we'd like it to. So it's just really using what we have and, you know, considering the purpose that you're using the model for and to inform it. And it could be that actually if you have better data, the results might not be that sensitive to that. So I guess that's what we tried to do, is just try and get a useful answer out of what we have.
And I suppose the sort of silver lining of the fact that so much rests on the extrapolations, or rather the projections we're going to make, makes it relatively less important how good the starting point is, which might sound a bit perverse, but it's, I'm sure you can appreciate the, sort of the balance between the two. So I mean, clearly, if incidence and resistance rates aren't changing at all, it'd be crucial to get a correct starting point. If the whole game is really around what's going to be happening in the next 10 or 20 years, it makes it much less important whether the starting point is 5% up or down by error of data or whatever other sorts of error you manage to conjure up.
Excellent. We've got one more question over there.
Hi, my name is Katrina. You had a slide on projected number of deaths due to antibiotic resistance by 2050. So these projected numbers, are they solely due to the antibiotic resistance development, or is it also, does it also include the population growth at the current rates?
Yes, so that slide was referring to the O'Neill review in 2016, and that used the models produced by KPMG and RAND. And my memory is slightly spotty on this because I looked into it about 9 months ago, but I think it did look at the kind of economic factors that fed into that and the population growth factors that fed in worldwide. So it was quite a different scenario from looking at the UK specifically, we're not really taking into account any of those population factors. We're just looking at how does it impact those mortality rates in the future or morbidity rates as well. So in answer, yes, it did take those into account, but then it also had quite a simplistic approach to looking at how resistance changed and also the effect of resistance on mortality rates.
Those figures are very influenced by the sort of global distribution of causes of death, and therefore, if like from the point of view of a UK actuary worried about their own parameterisation, those figures sort of overweight the influence of causes of death, which is sort of unknown, pretty much unknown to us in the UK, such as diarrhoea and tuberculosis, and lots of other things we'd imagine would be easily treatable. I mean, tuberculosis is a nice example of something which we always took for granted the last 50 years it could be treated with antibiotics, and now is obviously going to be one of the new sort of risk areas. But it's very much those figures are very oriented towards a sort of third world sort of doomsday scenario. Touch wood.
Excellent. We've got one more question over there. Last question for the evening.
Stephen's third question.
Just picking up on the preceding comment around the data and the trends in response, Matthew, I just wondered if the panel could comment at all whether or not there's any similar issues with the recording of ABIs to those with, for example, dementia, with increased awareness has led to increased diagnosis and therefore increased prevalence in appearing on mortality certificates. Is there anything similar happening with ABR, or can we... that might be distorting the trends that we'd have concerns with when it comes to...
Obviously, in terms of recording...
Yeah, or recording, or just great heightened awareness of ABR and therefore more likely to be actually acknowledged and recorded in the data over time that could cause any systemic distortions in the data you've been looking at.
I suppose it seems to be more clear-cut if you're sort of dying from pneumonia versus something completely... unknown, whereas the dementia is a very good example of where the sort of cause of death recording seems to have sort of undergone a suspicious sort of upward jump over the years, which probably though because it's the age where you're basically expiring with numerous things, and it could be one of many. Sometimes you could say the same about some of the respiratory bacterial infections, but I don't know whether you think it might be a
sure. I don't think it's a strong feature. As I say, having your pathogen isolated and identifying it as that's what you're ill with has always taken place with people who are very sick in hospital, who have an infection that can't be dealt with. So, I take into consideration the E. coli monitoring that hasn't been going on for very long in the UK, but that's showing definite increase since the monitoring started. And that's just on the background of the sudden awareness that E. coli was becoming much more prevalent as a untreatable pathogen in those circumstances, and it's those sort of events that tend to kickstart monitoring. So I would be surprised if Artifact had an awful lot to do with it, but it may play a part. But it's a sort of cut and dried thing. You have your pathogen isolated. So yeah.
I think there was some changes in the way deaths were recorded in terms of having a resistant version to a non-resistant version, and that's just starting to come through. But that's been also one of the difficulties in the sources of data.
Excellent. Thank you very, very much. I thought that was a really good talk, and we got some good questions from the audience. I think the prize for the fellow goes to Stephen. You worked really hard with all your questions he asked, so you can come collect your champagne afterwards. And then for the student prize goes to Lisa on the socioeconomic factors, so you can also come collect your prize afterwards. And then if we can just finish with thanking the speakers in the usual way.